going to open up the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on Monday, February 3rd, 2014. I'm going to open up, we're changing the agenda a little bit. We're going to have, the first hearing will be on House, The first thing we're going to do is adopt committee rules.
Chair Tomei, I'd move we adopt the proposed committee rules dated today, February 3rd, 2014.
Representative Gomberg moves that we adopt the proposed committee rules. Any discussion? Any objection? If that rules are adopted, what else do I need to do? Is that it?
Welcome a new committee member.
Welcome what?
Welcome a new committee member.
Oh, yes. Welcome a new committee member. Thank you. I need all the help I can get here. Representative Leininger, we are so happy to have you. Thank you so much for being in our committee. And welcome to the legislature.
Thank you. Aren't you going to have her give us a bio or something like that?
That's a good idea. Sure. You want to tell us a little bit about yourself, Representative?
Well, I know you have.
Are you kidding or are you being serious?
I have worked for a long time in the human services sector, but I come most recently from Oregon Iron Works, where I'm general counsel and a vice president. Before that, I was a Clackamas County commissioner and cared a lot about housing issues. And when I was at the Meyer Memorial Trust, I worked on housing issues, including efforts to try to help manufactured home park owners, tenants, buy the land under their units when it was...
We're gonna hold that one until we hear the bill.
So that's some of my experience.
Okay, great. And before that, you were with... Did you mention
Washington.
You were with Clackamas
yes.
County?
Yes.
Okay,
yep.
Great. Good. Thank you very much. All right, we're happy that you're here. With that, we're changing the agenda. We're going to hear House Bill 4124 first. With that, we will open up the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 4124.
Can I go down that way?
Sure. Yeah. Do you want to read this for a few
minutes? Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4124 renames the Youth Suicide Prevention Coordinator the Youth Suicide Intervention and Prevention Coordinator and specifies the location within the Oregon Health Authority as within mental health and addictions, refines and expands the coordinator's duties, requires the coordinator prepare annual report to the health authority and the legislature. It specifies the content of the report, requires the coordinator to update statewide strategic plan at least every 5 years, specifies the content of the update, requires the first update to the health authority and the appropriate legislative committees before January 1st, 2015, also defines youth and youth suicide, declares emergency as it is effective on passage. We have one dash one amendment, which slightly modifies the definition of youth and youth suicide to increase the upper age range from 19 to 24.
Thank you very much. Representative Gelser, thank you so much for bringing this bill to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from Corvallis in Philomath, which is where I live. And I should be joined shortly, Dr. Caroline Fisher, who is the Director of Child Psychiatry at Samaritan Health Services in Indiana. And not in Indiana. It's been a long afternoon.
Indeed.
In Corvallis and Philomath. In Corvallis. My psychiatrist will be here soon.
You need her.
I really do. So, colleagues, I had the opportunity to talk with you a little bit about this bill during our legislative days just a couple of weeks ago. And you will recall that this is the bill that will update, for the first time since 1997, Oregon's Youth Suicide Prevention Plan. That is currently in our statute, as is language that creates a position that's called the Youth Suicide Prevention Coordinator. This bill does a couple of simple things, and I want to be really clear up front. This bill does not solve our youth suicide problem, which is a very significant problem. Suicide is a significant public health problem for people of all ages across the state. This bill aims to help us better understand the intervention side of kids that are significantly in crisis. It aims to help us have more frequent and ready conversations about an issue that's really emotionally fraught and very difficult to talk about, particularly in the immediate aftermath in a community when when we've lost a young person, and the bill seeks to develop recommendations that can make our community safer and more responsive to kids that are at risk. The first thing that the bill does is changes the title of that position from a youth suicide prevention coordinator to a youth suicide prevention and intervention coordinator. It expands the population of young people that are addressed by that position from those that are deemed high, that are described directly as suicidal, and expands that to include youth who are suicidal, depressed, at risk, and self-injurious. The bill requires a report to us, the legislature, every year so that we can better understand the significance of this problem within our communities, and it asks the coordinator to look at making recommendations to make the system stronger, starting with an assessment of the timely, affordable, and culturally appropriate access to services when young people in crisis need them, and recommendations, because I'm assuming that there are probably some gaps in that system right now, some recommendations about how we might make that better. As I mentioned before, this would move that coordinator from the public health to addictions and mental health. It would be my preference that when this bill gets to Ways and Means, we are able to work with the co-chairs to find some additional funding so that we can actually add a second coordinator. However, I would argue that while it's ideal to have a coordinator in both addictions and mental health and in public health to coordinate with one another, if in a time of limited resources we must choose one, at this point we've done a tremendous amount of work on that upstream prevention, but we don't have people ready to receive the calls. When all of these people who have identified the at-risk kids make that phone call, we need to spend some time and energy making sure that people have access. At your place, there are a variety of materials. My two local papers, the Albany Democrat Herald and the Gazette Times, kicked off yesterday a series that's going to go on for the next several months about the issue of youth suicide. And you'll see in there some facts and figures that I wanted to share with you just because it's shocking, really. A reminder that 13.6% of Oregon 8th graders in 2011 through the Healthy Teen Survey indicated that they had seriously considered attempting suicide over the course of the past year. 3.5% of those 8th graders actually did try to take their own lives. 29% of boys and 41% of girls who lose their lives to suicide told somebody they were going to do it before they did in Oregon. 41% of girls and 29% of boys. In addition, 12% of the boys and 27% of the girls, it's by the time that they die of suicide, it's not the first attempt that they've had. So again, this points to the holes that we have in our response system because we know who these kids are. The suicide rate for Oregon as a whole has risen 21% since 2000. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for youth in Oregon, only behind motor vehicle accidents. The last time the Youth Suicide Prevention Plan was updated was 1997. In my two counties alone, in 2012, 5 10 to 24-year-olds died from suicide. And last year, between October 23rd and December 20th, we lost 3 young people to suicide. That doesn't count the attempts. And this one really got me. The number of years in which nobody between the ages of 10 and 24 died by suicide in either Linn or Benton counties since 2003, zero. The one other thing that I would point out is after this article ran yesterday, and I'm sure that you all have this experience when people talk about the work that you're doing and it runs in the paper, people start to call you on the phone. So I again started to hear the stories of families who are grappling with this that included another family of a 10-year-old who attempted suicide last week. And it struck me that this was the second person that's contacted me in recent weeks about a child that young in the same community, and that both of these people were people that I knew from other work in the community, which I think just points to how prevalent the issue is. The last item, two other pieces of things that I would draw your attention to. We do have a letter of support from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention at your seat, which is urging our passage of House Bill 4124. And the full text of the letter that I shared with you on the opening day is also there with the information redacted to protect the privacy of this family. But I just wanted to put that in the record again quickly. And this was a letter from this mother to me. Our child has struggled with mental health issues and depression since she was very small. She's had two acute hospitalizations and is currently in a residential mental health center 2 hours away from our home. She's talked about wanting to die since she was eight and has attempted to kill herself. We were on the Healthy Kids program and are on the Oregon Health Plan now. Trying to get help for our child has been heartbreaking. In November, we were desperate for help. We took her to the ER, where they threatened to restrain her to the bed. When the county crisis worker got there, 2 hours after we did, she had screamed herself to sleep. The worker looked down at us and her and said, "Things seem to have calmed down." He gave us a number and sent us home. There were more hurdles before getting her a bed in a city 2 hours away. It took weeks. My younger child had to stay with my parents. My husband had to quit his job, and we stayed with our child every minute, 24 hours a day. She got increasingly suicidal and violent. I was floored at the lack of help. The crisis workers were telling us, "This is a process. Take her to the ER if needed. Call the police. It takes time." This is a 10-year-old, by the way. On one of our worst days, I had my phone right next to me waiting to hear from the county. This was the same day a young person in our community tragically killed herself. The worker called us right before 5 o'clock and told us she's sorry she didn't get back to us, but there had been a suicide in the community, and it was a crisis. All I could feel was fear for my own child and anger that someone successfully killing themselves is what was finally the crisis. I would love the chance to help bring awareness to the issue and to help change the system. I want to respect my child's privacy, but would like the chance to help people have a greater awareness. I understand why Oregon has the suicide rate it does, and it's not the rain. And with that, I would turn it over to Dr. Bishop.
Before we turn that over, thank you so much for bringing this bill to us and bringing this information to us. I think in some of your materials that you've passed to us that they say that newspapers don't usually publish this because of the copycat sensation. So I think that probably most of us aren't aware of the prevalence of suicide of these kids. So it's really important that you've brought this to us. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, that is another important aspect of the bill. By bringing this to the attention of the legislature every year, by causing us to have a conversation about it, it allows our media, our newspapers, and our communities to have a conversation about this really important public health issue in a way that's not specific to an individual young person. My local papers, the Gazette Times and the Democrat Herald, we've had long conversations over the last number of months about how they wrestle with how to handle this issue, pointing out that if we had lost that number of kids to cougar attack, a flu, I mean, just name it, a dangerous intersection, the community would be furious and begging for solutions. But instead, we can't figure out how to talk about it. So they wanted to talk about this more generally, and I really applaud them for doing that. And I think we need to find a better way to do it because these families aren't alone.
Yes. Thank you so much. So will you stay there for questions after your presenter? So thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. I think I'm here primarily to tell you it really is as bad as it sounds.
And could you tell us your name?
I'm Dr. Caroline Fisher. I'm a child psychiatrist in Corvallis, Oregon. I'm the chief of child psychiatry at Good Samaritan Regional Medical Center. I'm speaking in favor of this bill. And as I said, I think I'm here primarily to tell you how really bad it is. So we have a wildly inadequate mental health system for kids. My patients, if they are suicidal, need to go to the ER usually 3 to 4 times, despite a letter from me, a board-certified child psychiatrist, saying that they merit inpatient hospitalization for their disorder 3 to 4 times before they will be hospitalized. The resources are so tight that that's what it takes to get in. The obstacles are so high that that's what it takes. And the overwhelming majority of kids don't come see me. I am the only prescriber currently in Benton County that takes Oregon Health Plan, mostly. That's almost true. They've got a total of probably 15 hours a week of psychiatry time. And so the overwhelming majority of kids don't ever see me. And they don't have any place to go when they are suicidal. We don't have a way to talk about it. We don't have a way to get immediate access to help. We don't have resources, even if you present a crisis. It's just not there. And what this bill does is bring that to your attention. It brings it to your attention every single year. Because the reason our mental health system is the way it is because of a series of choices that people have made over the years as to what priorities need to be. But they're made on the basis of what information you have. You make rational decisions based on the information you have. You don't have this information. This information is collected but never presented to you. And so in order for us to actually address this problem, why is it higher here and what can we do about it, you have to have the information. You have to have the feedback to know if it's getting better or worse.
So one of you said there are more child suicides or young people suicides here. And it's not because of the rain. Can you talk about what theories there are about why there are more suicides here in that age group?
I can't tell you for sure. It's an enormously complex problem, and we don't necessarily understand a lot about why people commit suicide. But I can tell you a lot of things that it's not. It's not that the stresses here are particularly worse than elsewhere. In fact, in many ways, it's a lot better here. We have a better education system than a lot of places. We have more intact communities than a lot of places. We have a lot of social services compared to other places, in some ways. But it appears that what we don't have is a functioning mental health system. We've got no treatment for the overwhelming majority of people. And so we don't take... To get into our mental health system, you have to really be severely and persistently mentally ill. But kids are not. By definition, they're kids. They haven't had time to become persistently anything, right? A lot of them are struggling with just persistently themselves. And yet, we have no way to treat them. So you go to the pediatrician's office, and the pediatrician's office says, hey, you know, are you okay? Do you have asthma? Do you need the dentist? All of the things that we care about. But currently, if you say, no, I'm depressed, they say, ooh, sorry about that. And they got no place to send the child. They've got no help in treating that child. They've got no resources to take care of that child. So my guess is that that's the problem, and I don't know that for certain, but if you look at here compared to where I used to practice in Massachusetts, Massachusetts has many more urban problems than Oregon does. It's a much more urban state. It has much the same level of drug abuse as Oregon does. It has a bigger disparity between rich and poor, which should actually worsen the suicide rate. And yet, it does not have the suicide rate that we have here. And I think it's because there's a lot more mental health treatment in Massachusetts.
Thank you. Any further questions? Good. Representative Gomberg.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I too would like to thank Representative Gelsen for bringing this measure forward. I wonder if you could talk just a moment about the Dash 2 amendments and extending the definition of youth for this particular purpose from age 19 to 24.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Gomberg. That reflects an error in the original drafting of the bill. When I started working on this legislation last year, it was after we had done some work on youth depression screening in schools. So in my mind, I was thinking about kids in schools, which takes you up through the age of 19. But traditionally, in the data collection, youth suicide is described up through age 24. So you're then also picking up your college students and others. That will align it more neatly with the data that we're able to collect and describe.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you. Again, thank you for bringing this to us. I had sort of two questions. One has to do with, you said something about the interventions being culturally appropriate. And, you know, I mean, I believe that there's a disproportionate ratio of suicide among GLTB questioning communities as well as our native communities. Can you just very briefly, just what are you, what's your thinking about these culturally appropriate approaches?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, two things. One, the bill does talk about collecting demographic information. There may be a further amendment to clarify where we're able to do that. In a small community, that might be a confidentiality issue, and we want to protect the confidentiality that people have. The second piece is that for mental health services to work, people have to be comfortable accessing them. And I think that language was an attempt to be consistent with some of the other work that we've done in terms of talking about culturally appropriate access to health care.
Okay. And my other question, actually, it's not so much a follow-up, it's another question. On this handout that you gave us, the one with the picture of these handsome representatives, it suggests that there's three parts to the bill. And the second part, as I read it here, it would also move the position, i.e. the interventionist position, from public health, which focuses on long-term prevention measures, to mental health, where the emphasis is on people currently in crisis. So basically what the bill is doing is taking us from a primary prevention model to a tertiary or secondary prevention model. And as you pointed out, I mean, it may be a question of one or the other, but at this point, because of the numbers, what you're saying is because of the incidence of suicide, we really need to focus these resources there and maybe come back to primary later on, maybe.
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, yes, I think that would be a disappointing outcome because I think that primary upstream prevention work is really important, and I worry about some of the things we might not be able to continue doing if we don't have that person within public health. But the fact of the matter is, if we go out and we train everyone in the community on mental health first aid, for instance, or on kind of assist in the schools, and people know how to recognize a kid that's in trouble, and we've identified all those kids in trouble, and we have no idea what to do with them after we've done that, we're stuck. So if we could spend some time developing the capacity to respond to all the calls that we're getting from the people who've been well-trained by the incredibly good work that has been done through our public health department, this is not a criticism of them at all, then I think we would be better off. I'm hopeful that all of you will help me in ways and means to make the argument that this is worth what's probably about a $150,000 investment in our kids.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Fisher, or Representative Gelser, actually, I'll start with you, Dr. Fisher. I mean, I'm aware of what the mental health first aid is all about, and I also know that the addictions on mental health has also been working with a number of the county directors on mental health around the state, too, for moving toward a program to remedy some of this. Have you been tied in with them on any of that? I mean, especially for Lynn and Benton counties?
Yes, lots.
Oh, have you? Okay, well, that's good. Can you kind of just share a little bit of what you've been doing?
So that sounded like one question, but it's in my head actually five or six, so I will do my best. So the state has had a number of requests for proposals for enhancing crisis services, RAP services, early intervention for psychosis, the ESA program, some mental health prevention, and some transitional age services. And I have been involved in the grant writing process and looking at the kind of quality control kind of aspects of that. I also work pretty closely with our local CCO, which is also Samaritan. And so in that capacity, I'm also working pretty hard at making sure that the services that are purchased are, in fact, the services that are needed. But all politics are local, and all local is politics. And so there are strains and pulls and tensions in that work. Ultimately, what it has to come down to in my mind, and what I hope it has to come down to in yours, is do we pay for something that gets us the outcome that we want? And I don't see any way to figure that out unless you've got a way to actually keep track of the outcome.
Okay. We're good. Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First for Representative Gelzer.
Are you going to ask me about Common Core?
No, ma'am. You want to comment on it?
No.
How will this affect the CCOs? Will they have to have a extra people, or is that going to change their contract or anything? Do you foresee?
No, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, this will not impact the CCOs. This does not require, it does not mandate anything of a county. It doesn't mandate anything of a CCO. It refocuses the job description, really, of this youth suicide prevention intervention coordinator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Dr. Fisher, you mentioned drug addiction and alcoholism. So we have a lot of data in some of the newspaper. Is the drug addiction and the alcoholism, is that a major factor in the youth suicide or not?
Complex question. So it appears that people are more likely to commit suicide when they are under the influence of an intoxicant. However, primary alcoholism is not necessarily the major cause of suicide in youth. A little bit more data in adults. But in youth, that's usually not the driving factor. So, sort of.
Just a final comment, Madam Chair. I know that Representative Olson on Judiciary Committee have gone out to some of the facilities for youth and how the girls cut them is one of the main things they look for in the girl inmates is that they're cutting themselves, which is really significant.
Self-harm is quite prevalent, particularly among adolescent girls, and the issue that we have is about 2% of people who casually self-harm will actually seriously attempt suicide. And so in and of itself, it doesn't tell you that they will or they won't. It just tells you it's a measure of distress, like fever is a measure of infection. It just tells you how bad things are.
Thank you for your response.
Any further questions? Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate it. And thanks for all the work you've done on this. And thank you again, Representative. And this is not going to take care of the problem. It's going to give us a little more information so we know where to go from here. So you have an amendment, but you're not presenting it today. Is that right?
Correct. I need to make a clarification for that confidentiality issue in the demographic data. And as soon as I get that back, it should be ready to go.
Great. And then we'll get the fiscal on that and then hopefully move it on to Ways and Means if the committee is so inclined.
And Madam Chair, the question that I've been wrestling with is whether... never mind.
All right. Ask one question about the fiscal. So what are the fiscal components? You're transferring one position over to another. I'm assuming that would be relatively the same. What are the other... Why would this cost any more?
Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, my understanding from talking to the folks at the Health Authority is that the position would need to be reclassed because you're looking at making some recommendations, so it would be elevated to a public policy, a policy analyst position. So you're probably looking at maybe $20,000, $25,000 over the course of the biennium for increased salary. The benefits are already there, so it's that personnel cost. And then obviously if in Ways and Means, and I think I would prefer to wait to add that amendment in Ways and Means if we can. That's what I was saying I was wrestling with there. I mean, you're probably looking at another $100,000, $125,000 to add that full second position. And those are just estimates that are not based in anything that's been written down anywhere, any place, at any time.
All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And we have two other people who are wanting to testify, Cheryl Meres and Courtney Johnston. Courtney, I think this is Courtney's first time to our committee, not certainly first time in the legislature. Welcome, both of you. Who would like to go first?
Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Gomberg, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Courtney Johnston, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of the National Association of Social Workers, which represents about 1,800 members in Oregon. As defined in our code of ethics, the primary mission of a social worker is to enhance human well-being and to ensure that basic human needs are provided to every member of our community, with particular attention to the needs and empowerment of people who are vulnerable, oppressed, and living in poverty. Our legislative committee has reviewed House Bill 4124 and supports the measure because we believe it will go a long way to help reduce instances of suicide among Oregon youths, which I believe you just heard is the second leading cause of death among Oregonians aged 15 to 34. So in addition to registering our support, I also just want to take a minute to thank Representative Gelser for sponsoring this measure, bring it forward, because frankly, I believe it's long overdue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions of Courtney before we move on? Thank you for your support.
Good afternoon, Representative Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and I'm testifying on behalf of the directors of community mental health programs and of health and human service departments and counties. Our legislative committee was able to review the bill as well, and we support the focus on the youth who are at risk for suicide and self-harm, and we would strongly suggest that as your local system of care partners, that ASCMHP and CLO, the Coalition
for... Could you tell us what those letters stand
Association
for?
Of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs and the Coalition for Local Health Authorities work with you on a collaborative plan that would be coordinated statewide between the Addictions and Mental Health and Public Health Divisions at the state. In addition, we would strongly encourage resources on the ground for good work that's being done to train people and to give them the tools that they need to help youth who are in crisis and who are exhibiting symptoms that may lead to suicide and self-harm. To that end, I just want to give an example, and I gave you written testimony and also a list of all of the youth mental health first aid instructors that have been trained since November 2013 in this curriculum. We're really excited about rolling out this particular training with the support from Addictions and Mental Health Division. We've trained the 63 instructors. There are additional 20-plus instructors trained in Multnomah County as well. And these instructors, for our goal for these instructors is to train 5,000 new mental health first aiders. These are adults who work with youth, teachers, high school, middle school principals, parent volunteers, after school programs, Boys and Girls Clubs, faith-based institutions, to recognize the signs and symptoms of a youth who has mental health issues or substance use issues, and can take certain steps to help them so that they don't get to the suicide level. We'd really like to see resources in this program. I'm very proud of this. It's also an anti-stigma program. And, I mean, you've seen reports after tragedies just like me, and I've seen so many times someone interviewed saying, I knew there was a problem, but I didn't know what to do. So youth mental health first aid helps people know what to do, gives them the tools to know how to identify the problems, gives them, listening skills and knowing how to refer them both to their network, whether that's a trusted adult or a peer, a pastor, whoever that may be in the community that can help them before they even get to this level of crisis or to the appropriate healthcare professional. So with that, I'd really like you to consider resources in that. And again, we'd like to work as your local system of care partners and help you with any plan that's developed statewide. And if anyone wants to know more about youth mental health first aid, I have a book here that goes to the mental health first aiders.
Thank you, Cheryl. Mm-hmm. Any questions? Cheryl, I have a question. So we heard Representative Gelser's story about the family that had needed help, and they called the crisis line, right? And so do we have a way to fix that so that never happens again on the crisis lines that you're familiar with?
That should really never happen. And at some point a couple of months ago, we did a survey on the crisis call numbers around the state. And for very good reason, they're either regionally or county-based, because people are there on the ground, with their cell phones needing to react as opposed to some central number. Mm-hmm. So there's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure. I don't know the the details of that particular incident, but we certainly should talk about that with your local mental health authority and, you know, the appropriate people. I don't know how that fell through the cracks. That should never happen.
So. I agree. Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you so much for coming to testify today.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
One piece of information I forgot to share. I did have the opportunity to go and visit with the AOC Public Safety Subcommittee this morning, and they voted to support this measure as well.
Fantastic. Good. That's great. Anything else? All right. With that, we will close the hearing on House Bill 4124. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 4038.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4038 requires manufactured dwelling park owners to provide written notice to park tenants and to the Oregon Housing and Community Services of interest in selling the park before marketing the park for sale or considering offers. It specifies the content of the notice, requires responsive written notice from tenants within 10 days if the tenants wish to compete to purchase the park, specifies the content of the response, permits tenants to request specified information during that 10-day period, requires the owner provide information within 7 days, establishes parameters to permit limited sharing of confidential information, requires tenants within 15 days of receipt of the requested information to form or associate with an entity capable of contracting and submit evidence of the capacity to contract along with their written offer, requires commercially reasonable conduct of the parties, provides owner immunity from liability for minor failures to comply with notice requirements or information provisions of information, permits tenants to seek injunctive relief for substantial owner noncompliance with notice or information requirements, unless the sale is completed by to a bona fide purchaser, and the greater of damages is twice the rent of each tenant as part of the relief. Requires OHCS make this information available to tenants of manufactured dwelling parks, excludes other types of transfer of real property, makes existing provisions that govern notice and transaction requirements between tenant associations or facility purchase associations for sales of a facility applicable only to sale of a marina to a tenant association or marina purchase association, and makes other conforming and corrective modifications. It takes effect the 91st day of after sine die. There is a dash one amendment that, while tweaking some of the details and replacing the measure, it comes across as what the members call a gut and stuff. It has substantially the same effect as what I've just described. Some of the changes that are notable are the injunctive relief for substantial owner noncompliance. It's when the owner fails to record the affidavit that is described in the measure prior to the sale, removing a language about a bona fide purchaser, and also defines the marina purchase association. There's no fiscal or revenue impact on the measure as introduced or on that dash one amendment, which is the only one we have.
Thank you. Very good, Cheyenne. Thank you. So, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13, and I'm very pleased to be here today with my colleague, Representative Wisnett, who will be speaking also. I'd like to summarize what's gone on for the last year or so since you heard a bill in the previous session. There was a work group that was appointed at the chair's urging. The work group had the following membership. There were two state representatives, Representative Wisnett and me, three persons representing tenants or park residents, and seven persons representing landlords or owners. We had three in-person meetings when we were all together in the summer and fall. Representative Wisnett and I together toured a resident-owned park in Redmond, and we have met separately or together with some of the various parties who are interested in this. The work group came to an agreement on November 19th, agreeing on the form and the content of the bill. The bill wasn't available, however, until about 2 weeks ago, so the many parties involved, especially the attorneys representing both the tenants and the park owners, have been working on fine-tuning that initial draft. There were many words that all the parties involved felt needed to be changed to clearly match the work group's recommendation. It wasn't because people were changing their minds. It was because on reading the draft, they felt that the words weren't quite adequate to convey what the agreement was among the parties. So that's why you have a dash one amendment. It represents the efforts of those parties over the last 2 weeks. This bill is a very different approach from the proposal you heard last year, which was House Bill 3007. It differs in three fundamental ways. It is much simplified. Number two, it has much shorter timelines and less onerous obligations and penalties. And three, this approach is no longer from the perspective of landlord-tenant law. Instead, we are following the advice, the recommendation, the counsel of the parties who were in the work group who said, let's just follow standard commercial real estate practice for standard commercial real estate sales. So it will be more straightforward to understand. It's more clear in what's already in practice in the commercial real estate community, and it will be more comfortable for park owners to be able to understand and comply with. This approach that we're recommending from the work group has been characterized, and I've heard this from both sides, gee, we gave up a lot. Both sides feel like there has been a lot of change. It's true, the tenants, the residents, the homeowners have given up a lot. And here's one very important example. The time period in question had covered a maximum of 100 days, 100. Now that is reduced to just 25. That was a very large reduction in that window of time. For buyers who are in a hurry because they have a 1031 exchange deadline coming up, those transactions continue to be exempt. That's still not a worry. And in creating this much simplified approach, I guess one of the main points I want to leave you with is that this simplified approach, we agreed at that November 19th meeting that not every single possibility would be addressed. We wouldn't try to have words that described every legal technical process or aberration that might come up or option. Instead, the group, meaning both sides, felt comfortable generally in both sides acting in a straightforward manner, in good faith, and also making sure that the residents showed that they had skin in the game. So that's what the work group came up with. It's not as complicated or as complex as the previous bill, and that's because both parties agreed, let's make this simpler, let's just make it work. So we've been fine-tuning it. We think this is a good approach, and we appreciate your allowing us time to present this to you as your bill.
And we really appreciate the work that the two of you have put into this as a subcommittee to this committee, and also with all the people who were involved in the work group. So thank you very much. Representative Whitman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and especially to you and this committee for allowing Representative Nathanson and I to take on this very difficult. It was not easy. But I was once told when I first came in the building, you never want to get between barbershops and salons and legislation. You never want to get by. And I actually broke the law. I got between ophthalmologist and optometrist on a visual screening bureau with Speaker Kotek. And now we're between owners of manufactured park homes and the tenants. But I think Representative Nathanson gave you a good review of what happened. I think in both of us, we first meeting, we tried to establish what we're trying to do, and everyone involved agreed that we were here to try to assure we have this housing. There is a population that needs this kind of housing, and we do not want to do anything that's going to eliminate that housing, because a lot of the housing is owned by corporations or big companies that are in it for the money, but they are also providing a housing source that we have a certain part of the population that needs it. We, as Representative Nathanson said, we had several meetings with a whole group, and one-on-ones and two-on-twos and three-on-threes, but good meetings, good discussions, and I really support what she said as far as this is a new concept. As we did agree, one of our lawyers suggested that we make it, it's easier to understand, less complication if you'd use a commercial example of what you're selling, and that's what we're doing. But I do, Madam Chair and committee members, and I think I have the Representative Nathanson's support. We did not get the Dash 1 until Thursday late Thursday, And some of the people were, and we're not going to have a unanimous approval of this bill. It's going to be a consensus bill. But I think I would ask, because we worked so hard to give us the work group one more time to check and see if we can accept any of the, we did get some suggested changes to the Dash 1 today. And so we are prepared. We have it set up to have a work group meeting this afternoon and see if we do need a more, if we can do more amendments or not. And so you'll have plenty of time. The committee will and chair would have to either accept those amendments or move the bill. I think we can get them back in the notes. We have till next Wednesday, actually, to do the work session, but I think we can get it back sooner than that if we do
I hope so. I would hate to put it off very long.
Well, you can Madam Chair, I'm prepared to vote. If we don't have them back, we'd move it forward with Senate, but I think we'll have them back because we're going to meet today, and there's not that many. We have a three-page. The last person that came in just had a three-page comments on it, so I think, and it's a, what is it, a 23-page bill now?
Yeah, it's a long bill.
I think we've narrowed it down to just a couple of issues that I'd like to resolve for those people, that group that still wanted some comments or changes to the bill. I think it will be a good policy, as Representative Nathanson clearly identified. And if you read the bill, the owner has a chance to walk away at any point, not to accept accept the offer from the tenants. And we address confidentiality. We've done a lot of the work group did a lot of hours, spent a lot of time on this, and our objective was to try to address concerns of the owners and the tenants, and to have a policy that would be workable.
That's great. Thanks for your work. That's tough jobs to do. Thank you. Any quick questions? All right. This is affordable housing. That's part of our goal here, is to find and keep affordable housing in our communities. So this is affordable housing for a lot of people who couldn't afford any other housing. So it's so important to retain these. Thank you so much for your work.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I add one little detail based on your comment that you just made? There are over 1,100 parks in Oregon. Those parks are in 57 of our 60 representative districts, and it is right now providing more than 63,000 residential spaces for affordable housing.
That's a lot of housing. Great. Thank you for that. All right. So we have several people who are wanting to speak. John Van Lanningham, Chuck Carpenter, and Charlie Reef. Yep. Thank you. Coming up, there should be three seats there. Charlie, come on up too.
I don't want to put him between us.
Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Lanningham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Lane County. I've appeared before you a bunch of times talking about manufactured home parks over the last 15 years, although I know your committee didn't exist for 15 years. And I typically represent tenants on issues like this. I'm here with Chuck Carpenter on behalf of the owners. We both strongly endorse 4031-38.1 as it is. We were, Chuck was not, but his lawyer, Phil Quirin, was a member of the work group, as was I. You heard Representative Nathan describe the work of the work group. I, with Phil Quirin, Chuck's lawyer, drafted the compromise proposal, which the work group generally agreed to on November 19th. Everyone in this world has had a copy of that proposal since November 19th, including Mr. Greff. It is a good stuff, but that reflects the struggle to get legislative counsel to write that two-page memo, compromise proposal, correctly. There have been no changes to the compromise proposal. None, substantively. I can go through the 4038-1 and show you line by line how it reflects that November agreement. We got an LC draft back for the first time on January the 15th, I think, on January 16th. It was shared with you at your interim January committee meeting. I emailed that to Mr. Greff that evening, along with my memo back to Legislative Council saying, no, it's not right. We need these changes. So I think that Mr. Greff has seen the changes that we've been trying to make to get the bill right, and that's all we've been trying to do. I don't want to lose this bill. And I think Mr. Carpenter would say the same thing. And I'm worried about delay, losing the bill. I appreciate Representative Wisnant's leadership. I have agreed. I know he's acting sincerely here. And I've agreed to attend the meeting tonight and see if we can work out some other things. If there are changes needed, I'm open to changes. I'm always open to changes to make things better. I don't agree that the memo lists things that have to be that would make it better, but I'm certainly prepared to talk about that. I would prefer that we not put this over to Friday if we can possibly come back on Wednesday. I'm very concerned about the delay.
Is that Wednesday is a very, very, very
busy
full agenda.
For you. Okay.
Very full agenda.
Yeah, I mean, that's your call.
I would be happy to do that.
Okay.
Members of the committee, Representative Tomei, my name is Chuck Carpenter. I'm Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We have about 490 communities that are members of the association, representing about 30,000 spaces. I have been dealing with this issue through the coalition for, I would say, about the last 5 years. And I understand very well that this is a very contentious issue, that anytime you have one piece of property on top of somebody else's, it becomes a contentious issue. And we have worked very hard in two of the past legislative sessions to reach a consensus on this issue. We worked successfully in the last legislative session in 2013 to defeat House Bill 3007, which we thought was a particularly onerous piece of legislation. And because of our ability at that time, that the perceived defeat of that bill, we agreed to be in this work group. And I would have to say that we are satisfied with the product that that work group has produced. And many of my board members of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon have commented that it is a better product than we ever imagined we would come up with in the coalition over the last 5 years. So we too, the MHCO board, which has unanimously voted twice for this proposal that you have as the -1 amendments, have support the position of moving this bill. And we do not want to take a chance of having this bill lost in this session and then coming back in the 2015 session and having to revisit something like House Bill 3007 or something similar to that. With that being said, we always understand that other people have different perspectives on that, and we're willing to listen to those perspectives. But I do want the committee to know that from MHCO's standpoint, from Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, we support this bill. Philip, these are the owners of Manufactured Home Communities. Phil Quirin worked through the last year. He's been very involved with this. He's the association attorney, and he's worked very hard on this issue and against John to come up with something that he felt was acceptable to community owners. Is this a perfect bill? No. Do all the members of the Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon are they happy with this? No. Is this better than what we thought we could get in these negotiations? Yes. And so we're fine with talking about this evening and trying to come up with some changes to the -1 amendments, but I want to be very clear to all of you that Manufactured Housing Communities Oregon supports this bill. We don't want to lose it. If we can move this bill out of this committee on Wednesday, we would be happy rather than waiting until Friday or next week and run the chance that we go back to the drawing board, which we would find to be unacceptable. We've worked on this for a year, but to be honest with you, Representative, all of us, Charlie, John, and myself, have been involved in this for years.
Yes.
And we all have a different perspective on that, which I respect. But we feel that given the lay of the land, so to speak, this is about as good a deal as we're going to get.
Thank you. Any quick questions? Actually, it doesn't have to be quick.
Since I was new last session, I was just wondering if currently tenants can purchase mobile home parks. Is that correct, according to the law now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Has there been a case or cases in the past where they have not been able to?
Well, I can see out of the corner of my eye that my opponent is disagreeing with me. John Van Landing, I'm, Madam Chair, Representative Whitsitt. That's a complicated question with a complicated answer. I have a memo that describes how HB 4038 is significant improvement on current law. There is current law that describes the rights and responsibilities of owners and residents with regard to purchase obligations. So I don't agree that the current law works well for either side. So, and then I think the law improves that for both sides, but obviously he disagrees.
We haven't heard that yet. So.
He may be here for another 5 years.
Hopefully not.
Any other questions? Okay, I think we're setting you up.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Charlie Greff. I'm an attorney. I practice out of Lake Oswego, Oregon. I represent the Oregon Park Owners Alliance, better known as OPOA. And this is an organization of mobile home park owners that has been active with the legislative coalition group since, I would say, about 1999 or so. And at the end of the last legislative session, all parties involved, the tenants, MHCO, CASA, all and the OPOA all promised to work together toward a mutually agreeable arrangement to facilitate the tenants' objectives and yet protected the park owners. And however, the OPOA was left out of the process. The MHCO and the tenants on their own.
Okay, we're going to need words instead of letters, so help us with that.
Yeah, MHCO and the tenants, these groups represented to my left, without involving my client, reach an agreement which takes the form of the Dash 1 amendments of House Bill 4038. And again, OPOA was not included in those
OPEA
discussions.
Again, tell us who they are.
The Oregon Park Owners Alliance.
So help us understand. So you represent park owners and you represent park owners,
different
right?
groups.
Tell us about these groups, because I'm confused.
Sure. The Oregon Park Owners Alliance is very similar to the MHCO in that it's a consortium of park owners.
And how many owners are you talking about?
I would say we have in the range of 30 to 50 is my just a ballpark.
Okay.
Madam
and
Chair.
Chuck, and how many do you represent?
We have 489 manufactured home communities.
489. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
See, that's helpful.
Although in terms of actual spaces rented, that isn't necessarily that far out of proportion, because many of our clients have very large parks with lots of spaces. But nonetheless, we have been a stakeholder in the coalition group since the late 90s, and certainly during all of these discussions. We were promised that we would be a player in these negotiations, and then on November 19th, it was announced that the MHCO, through their attorney, Mr. Quirin, and the tenants, had reached an agreement. And the first time we saw this agreement was on or about November 19th. Well, we promptly reacted and submitted our own redlined revisions to what was then LC 103. And those revisions now just today made it into the Dash 2 amendment. So if you have those in front of you, they do reflect what we would ask be included as part of this legislation. But the proponents of the underlying bill, Madam Chair, continue to fail to identify a problem. And to answer Representative Whitsitt's question more specifically, that we have asked over and over again for an anecdotal example of a park sale that has failed to go through on behalf of the park tenants, but for what they're asking for, this new legislation. Essentially, this is a solution in search of a problem. But nonetheless, despite all that, the OPOA is willing to work with these other groups and put together a bill as reference. If you look at the Dash 2 amendments, if we can include those amendments, we have agreement. But if our changes essentially, Madam Chair, simply make this a fair and balanced piece of legislation. Our position has always been the need for a balanced approach between the owners and the tenants. Our changes require that the tenants organize patronize before making a decision to purchase a community, rather than a landlord having to send a tenant, mail a tenant a notice, where the tenant may not get the notice, or who knows if they're still a tenant. There are all kinds of vagaries in the proponent's view of the legislation that they're advocating here. Our changes would allow the park owners to get documents and information from the tenants, just as the tenants have that right against the landlord. Our changes would provide a remedy to the landlord who suffers as a result of the tenants. If they misuse the process, if they invoke it in bad faith, if they don't keep documents confidential, which is called for in the -1 amendment, much in the same way as the tenant has a remedy against a non-compliant landlord. So we're trying to make this a more fair and balanced bill. Had we been included in these negotiations many months ago, we could have gone over those changes. But it wasn't until November 19th that we were told about the deal that they had reached. So given the short time frame of this session, if we can agree on the -2 amendments in their entirety, I think we have a deal that works for the OPOA. If we can't, then it makes every bit of sense to go back to work session and revisit this legislation in the 2015 regular session. And so we would ask that if all of the -2 amendments can be agreed upon by the three main parties here, that we would ask for a due pass recommendation. But if not, we would ask that it not pass out of committee and that we continue working on this until 2015.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Yes.
Thank you. What is the response of the other two parties to what we've just heard about the idea that the OPOA was not aware of this information until November 19th?
Madam Chair, member of the committee, Representative Leininger, I'd like to respond to that and defend the interim work group process. The co-chairs were very clear at each of our three meetings in saying, are there any proposals? All parties were invited to bring a proposal to the table. Mr. Greff's organization brought two proposals over our meetings. The first was that we not do a bill at all, under the argument that there was not a problem, we don't need any change in the law. I believe that Representative Wisnett and Representative Dan Thiessen both felt that they had a commitment to bring a compromise bill back to the committee, which is what they worked hard to do. The second proposal that Mr. Graff's organization brought at the next meeting, second meeting, was that instead of, if we were to have a bill, it would simply require landlords to give notice to tenants when the landlord had decided to close the park and redevelop, have the land redevelop it himself or herself, or sell it to somebody who would redevelop it. Our response was, that doesn't work. At that point, the land is worth far more than it would be as a park. That will never facilitate the preservation of any park or any sales to residents. It's just not practical. After that second meeting, in the third meeting, Mr. Quarren and I exchanged a number of emails and calls and talking about what parameters that we could do, come to agreement. And I think he and I reached an agreement on something like November the 17th when I was in Washington, D.C. at a meeting. We brought that outline to the last meeting of the work group. We only had three work groups scheduled. And we reviewed that for a two-hour meeting. And we invited questions, suggestions. As noted earlier, there were seven landlord representatives in this work group. Five of them were from Mr. Greff's organization. Two from Mr. Carpenter's organization. They asked for two changes in the proposal. We made those two changes. The draft that you got 2 days later at your normal meeting in November included those two changes. Mr. Greff just now said that he gave a redlined critique of the proposal promptly. The redline critique was to the LC draft. We didn't get the LC draft until January the 15th. You got it on January, I think, the 16th. I got his redline draft last Wednesday. That I would not call a prompt response to a proposal that was detailed, two pages, single-spaced, on November 19th, saying, this is the deal. And the draft that you have in front of you, the -1, simply reflects that deal. There is nothing in the draft that is not in that deal. Is that responsive? I'm sorry if I'm showing my frustration.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, our concern at the Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon was that as we went into the November 19th meeting, without any concrete or any possible resolution of this issue, that we were going to be faced with House Bill 3007 during this session. And so there was great discussion about what the compromise would be. What was reached in that meeting on the 19th that everyone was in attendance with was then sort of distilled down into a memo by Phil Quarin, Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon's attorney. And that was presented to the MHCO board in the beginning of December. The board unanimously supported those concepts. We posted those concepts on our website, mhco.org. And so I think it was pretty clear to anybody involved in the industry at that point that we were moving ahead with this agreement. And as I said, the board was very favorable to that. I circled back that Thursday night after getting the -1 amendments to make sure that everybody was still on board, and that's the case. So I think that it's been pretty evident what we've been working on. There was seemed to be indication at the March 19th meeting that some people did not accept that agreement. What's that?
November 19th.
On November 19th. But we felt, Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon felt, that it was important to resolve this issue once and for all. As I've said, we've been dealing with this for 5 years. There's really nothing that we've talked about here in the last half hour that we haven't talked ad nauseum for the last 5 years. So, and as I said, I realize this is a very emotional and difficult issue. But again, from our standpoint, we feel that it has been out in the public domain. Everybody should know what we've been working on. I believe that Mr. Greff's client was well aware of what we were working on, considering some of the text messages that I got on November 19th. She was not too pleased about the agreement that we had reached. But our instructions, the association's instructions to Mr. Quarin, was to make sure that you work with Mr. Van Lanningham and come up with draft legislation that reflects the agreement of November 19th and the memo that Mr. Quarin subsequently drafted that reflects that agreement. So I'm sorry that some people feel they haven't been included in the process. That is not how we see it. We feel that it's important to put this issue fairly and responsibly to bed, and we would like that to happen this session.
I was on the House Consumer Protection Committee, and we've heard testimony about this same legislation for years and years, so it's not just in the last 2 years in this committee. So it seems to me that I've heard over and over again how important these issues are, that everybody be involved. It sounds like that's what I've heard from Representative Nathanson and Representative Wisnitz. There's been a lot of work here. And I just was talking with the committee person, and we will carry this bill over to Wednesday. And certainly the intent of the chair, and I think of other people, that this bill will move forward. So I hope you have a successful meeting this afternoon or this evening so that you can come to some agreements. But it's certainly our intent to, after these many, many years and many, many hours that have been spent on this legislation, that we can pass something on Wednesday. Any other questions or comments?
I just have one. Could you just, in really basic terms, tell me what it is that you can't agree on this last point, if you will, that...
Well, I can tell you that I don't quite know yet, because our proposed revisions have been circulated and I haven't heard any objection to them. I assume that they object to the bulk of our revisions, which again are within the -2 amendment of this bill. I will say, though, that leading up to November 19th, I was not in any email communication with Mr. Quarin or, for that matter, Mr. Carpenter about Mr. Quarin's memo or any of it. I didn't hear about any of it until after November 19, when I received the first supposed agreement, LC-103. So to the idea that posting on a website is somehow reaching out to OPOA, who's a stakeholder in this group, is absolutely not true. But the answer to your question, I think, is I'm hoping this afternoon when we meet with Mr. Wisnant, we can give those changes a fair shake.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Whitsitt, John Van Lanningham, let me just note that, again, Mr. Greff's client handpicked five representatives to the work group. It was her decision whether to include Mr. Greff in the work group. Mr. Carpenter picked two people to represent his organization, one of whom was his lawyer, the other of whom was a park owner who has been involved with the coalition. It's a little hard. Well, I'll just leave it at that. The dash two amendments that Mr. Greff drafted and gave to us, I got from Mr. Kosasan last Wednesday morning, make significant changes to the concept that came out of the work group. I've got a two-page memo listing those where they are different and where they're not acceptable. One example would be a requirement that the residents pre-register as a corporation, well, actually as a homeowners association, which is a bad term to use in this context, that they incorporate as a homeowners association and notify the state that they are interested in purchasing the park if the owner ever decides that he or she wants to sell. This is an issue that we have discussed in the coalition for 5 years. That's a difficult thing for an organization to exist, a nonprofit organization to exist, when it has no purpose other than to wait for something to happen that may never happen. I mean, it's hard to keep people involved in organizations unless they have something to do. So the tenants have consistently said, that's a bad idea. Plus, who's going to keep track of that? People die. You know, you're going to form an organization, and then people die, and 5 years later, how are you going to find those people? I mean, there were just lots of reasons that's not something that we think is practical for anybody. I could keep going, as I obviously am wont to do here. I'll stop there.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much. I know it's a very difficult issue. Thank you for coming. So I think we're through with our business for the day. We will meet again on Wednesday, 3:00. And thank you all.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session for the public hearing on 4038, and close the House Committee on Human Services.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.